Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A new investigation by the Associated Press exposes widespread labor and human rights abuses, including rape, slavery, and child labor in the palm oil industry, which is worth a whopping $65 billion. 85% of the world's palm oil comes from Malaysia and Indonesia. Palm oil is in food and everyday products, including Oreo cookies, which is owned by Nabisco, Kit Kat bars, which is owned by Nestle, and Lysol cleaners. It's also in personal care products from L'Oreal, Procter & Gamble, and Toms of Maine, which is owned by Colgate. Some of the world's top banks and financial institutions are pouring billions of dollars into this industry, including Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, and HSBC. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, palm oil has soared from just 5 million tons in 1999 to 72 million tons today. Over the last two decades, the United States alone has seen a 900% spike in demand. Associated Press reporters Margie Mason, and Robin McDowell spoke to 130 current and former workers from two dozen palm oil companies, and almost every worker complained about how they were treated. Some said they were held against their will, raped, or regularly harassed. Just 2 days after the first part of the investigation was published on September 25th, U.S. lawmakers said the government must ban the import of products made with child or forced labor. So what will it take to protect these workers and regulate this industry? Joining us now is Margie Mason, an investigative reporter and Asia medical reporter for the AP. In 2016, Margie worked on an investigation about slavery in the seafood industry. And I hope you can take some time to read her latest pieces, Rape, Abuses, and Palm Oil Fields Linked to Top Beauty Brands. Hi, Margie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. These pieces were really hard to read, but so, so important. They are the most comprehensive dives into labor abuses in the palm oil industry. Can you just tell us how you and Robin went about this? Because it was so in-depth and you spoke to so many workers.
Yes. As you mentioned, we had been working earlier on abuses in the seafood industry. And Robin and I have both spent many, many years in Southeast Asia. And I think in some ways, this was a continuation of that. We had been looking at the Rohingya, which is a persecuted Muslim minority group in Myanmar that had been forced to flee their homes. And many of them had been going into Malaysia because they have ties there. And Malaysia had been somewhat open to allowing them in. And so I think initially we started with the question, with all of these Rohingya pouring in and with there being a shortage of labor in the palm oil industry, are some of these Rohingya winding up on plantations there? Have they been trafficked? Are they being forced to work? And then we started thinking about looking at Indonesia, and Robin and I both had spent many years there. And so we knew that there were problems there. And we also knew that when people think about the palm oil industry, they usually their mind goes to environmental destruction or abuses there involving loss of habitat or orangutans losing their homes or things like that. And so we really wanted to shine a light on the labor issues. And it was quite an undertaking. It took a really long time. But, the results have been hard for a lot of people to read, I think.
How were you able to connect with workers? Because a lot of the women who spoke to you spoke in secret, so there would be no retaliation.
Right. So basically, we had to do a lot of planning, and it was spending a lot of time kind of working out strategies, because first and foremost, we wanted to make sure that we weren't putting these workers at any risk of retaliation later. So we developed networks and sources, and we worked through trusted people, and were able to find places where we could meet with these workers. And sometimes that was in the plantations. A lot of times it meant finding times when they weren't working, which is a lot of the time. So we would meet at night a lot, and they would come out, and we would meet at coffee shops or hotels or places where they were away from the plantation and it was safer for them.
I remember when the palm oil industry first started getting a lot of attention, we did a show many years ago with members of the Girl Scouts who had a campaign, a successful campaign, to ensure that there was no palm oil in Girl Scout cookies. And since then, it has just exploded. I mean, just reading your piece and learning that palm oil is in almost every product you can name, from personal care products like Tom's of Maine, Nabisco Kit Kat bars, I'm sorry, Nestle Kit Kat bars, Lysol, pet food, pesticides. I mean, palm oil has just really exploded. Why is that? What explains that?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I think the number one reason is that it's cheap. And when you look at foods, the United States, for instance, needed to switch. There were bans against trans fats, and they needed to find something to put in products. And palm oil is almost a magical oil. As you mentioned, it's in so many products. It's in paint. It has a long shelf life. It doesn't, you can use it at high temperatures, and it doesn't smoke up the kitchen. In places like India and China, they actually use it in Indonesia as well. I mean, it's used for frying. It's used to help preserve foods. Yeah. It is used to keep oils and waters from separating. So in peanut butter, for instance, that's what keeps your peanut butter together. It's used in so many beauty products. It helps to soften. It helps to clean. It helps to bubble. And so it's just so versatile, and it's cheap. And it's actually, when compared to other oils, you don't need nearly as much space. I mean, it's just incredibly, incredibly efficient. And so that's also really appealing as well. Unfortunately, I think what's happened is the industry has just exploded, and it's really hard to kind of keep tabs on what's happening in these faraway places that are literally in the middle of the rainforest, or what was once a rainforest.
You also report that in many cases, if you look on your label, the palm oil is not called palm oil. There could be a scientific name like hydrogenated palm glycerides or ethyl palmitate or octyl palmitate. I don't know if I'm saying those right. And then the other thing that really was interesting, ingredients that are derived from palm oil. And I'm sure that so many listeners have seen these ingredients on the back of their products, kernel oil, fruit oil. Sometimes you have the word palm in it, but then you've got stearate, stearic acid, sodium lauryl sulfates is in so many things. Sodium lauryl, sodium kernelate is in so many things. So you've got also these ingredients that are derived from palm oil.
Absolutely. And I think you've just nailed it. You know, people want to know if there's palm oil in their products. And Robin and I spent, I can tell you, we spent an enormous amount of time trying to figure out, is this palm oil or is this not palm oil? And oftentimes the companies were not always transparent about it, or maybe they didn't even know, because it can be in some cases derived from palm or perhaps coconut. So, you might not even be able to get a straight answer from a company if you ask them. And it's very challenging. The names are, often it goes through a number of processes, and unlike in food, where you can actually look at, say, like a Kit Kat bar, and you can see oftentimes it'll just say palm oil or palm kernel oil. But when you're dealing with cosmetic products, it's extremely difficult because they don't have to say. And again, these are derivatives. And so the names can be very long and hard to say. And again, even if you see the word palm in it, it might mean that it came from coconut. Although we do know that it would be extremely expensive for everybody to be using coconut oil. Palm is so much cheaper and more available. So, you know, I think it's basically almost three out of four cosmetic products you're going to find some derivative of palm oil in it. Wow.
We'll talk more about what citizens can do about this, but if you're buying something and it says stearic acid or sodium lauryl sulfate, for example, should you assume that that's a derivative of palm oil? Or once again, do we have to write the companies to ask the questions and, you know, demand that this is not taking place?
Well, I think that, again, if it's a cosmetic product, you can look at the label and oftentimes see the word palm or see another form of, you know, what is probably some derivative of palm oil. But I do think that it's good to contact the companies because they need to know that this is something that people are concerned about and that they're watching and that they want to know about and that they want them to be transparent. I think people want to know what's in our products. And again, I think we were really surprised in a lot of ways. I mean, these are things that we're putting on our skin, things we're putting on our children or even our babies. And so what is it? What are we actually using? And so, yeah, I think that it's a really good idea because that also lets the companies know that this is something that is gaining momentum and that people do care about.
And what can you tell us about, quote, sustainable sourcing of palm oil? Because a lot of brands have been bought by multinational corporations. And so, for example, Tom's of Maine is a very popular toothpaste that's in natural food stores, and it's owned by Colgate. Well, Colgate has an entire section on their website that says our policy on responsible and sustainable sourcing of palm oils. And of course, they say we support a vision for a future without deforestation. On this page, it looks like there isn't much information on. Oh, yeah, there is information actually on labor rights. It says guided by the UN Declaration of Human Rights under a policy of no exploitation. Colgate requires its suppliers to all tiers to commit, and they have all of these, you know, this information on their website. So what should someone do if they do some research and then they find this kind of information on a corporate website?
I think that's another really great question. Most of the companies, the big companies that you've named, they all have policies. Most of them are members of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, which is the association that, you know, works and tries to push the industry toward more sustainable palm oil. And again, this has largely been focused for many years now. There's been a lot of pressure, especially from big groups like Greenpeace, to work on, you know, palm oil plantations not moving more into virgin rainforest and destroying more peatlands or other, you know, forests, basically. And so, you know, a lot of the policies that you'll see are kind of focused more toward the environmental side, although most companies also do still have some type of policy against slavery or child labor or these type of things. But, you know, one of the things that we pointed out in the story is that, you know, a number of the plantations that we visited or the mills where their fruit was feeding into were certified as sustainable by the RSPO. And so, you know, many of the grievances that have been filed since the RSPO was created in 2004, again, have been aimed more at environmental destruction or land grabbing and that type of thing from indigenous people. We are starting to see more in the past, you know, maybe two, 3 years, especially focused on human rights issues and labor issues. But I think in large part, the people working on these plantations have really kind of been invisible. And we're hoping that now there's going to be a little more momentum and at least people will see them for the first time. And hopefully, there'll be some change in the industry. But I think it's going to be difficult.
In one of your pieces, you travel to one of the world's largest palm oil companies. This is in Malaysia. It's a government-owned plantation called Felda. Can you tell us more about who actually owns these plantations and the money connected to them?
Yeah. So in that particular case, that was Felda is state-owned, and it is one of the largest palm oil companies in the world. It also has an affiliated company called FGV Holdings, which recently the U.S. government has banned all shipments of palm oil from FGV because of labor abuses, including child labor. So, you have a lot of companies that are privately owned. You have a lot of money flowing in to these palm oil companies, either directly or indirectly, often through Asian banks. And one of the things that we focused on in the first piece is kind of looking at, the financing and, okay, where does the pressure come from or where could the pressure come from? And we found that, a lot of money is being channeled, either directly or indirectly into these palm oil companies. And I mean, it's, CalPERS, big pension schemes. It is, Vanguard. So it's connected to our 401ks. It is Citigroup. It's so many different. You think about if you take a loan out for your house or go to the ATM or write a check or anything, you are connected to this in some way. And I think that, a lot of pressure, the banks can actually put a lot of pressure on the industry to do better.
Other banks include Charles Schwab, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan. And in the story, Gemma Tillack of the Rainforest Action Network said, "The buck stops with the banks. It is their funding that makes this system of exploitation possible." Today, we are speaking with Margie Mason, investigative reporter and Asia medical reporter for the Associated Press. Margie and Robin McDowell wrote two incredible investigations about widespread labor and human rights abuses, including rape, slavery, and child labor in the palm oil industry. You can find the pieces at yourcallradio.org. You can also see these just incredible photos that really show you what it looks like, the workers, and just the importance of elevating the voices of workers. If you have any questions for Margie, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So we went over the basics of palm oil, the labeling, all of the money that's connected to it. Let's now just talk about the brutal labor that is involved in working in these fields. Can you first tell us, before we talk about JUM, one of the people you spoke to who basically said that he's being forced to work in these fields, what is the physical labor like for the workers on these palm oil fields?
Palm oil is extremely physically demanding. There aren't a lot of machines, so everything is kind of done by people. And the trees grow very tall. It's extremely hot. It's Southeast Asia, so it's a tropical sweltering heat. Oftentimes, they are not equipped with proper gear, so they might not have, some of the women, right? They work barefoot. The men are tasked with kind of going out, and they have these really long poles and there's basically like a sickle on the end of the pole. And so then they have to, you know, it's almost like a dance, a choreographed dance where they put the pole up and they have to, you know, hook it without damaging this giant, kind of looks like a big blackberry almost, covered in needle-like spikes, and they weigh up to 50 pounds. And so they have to then slice this, and then it falls, and they have to keep it from falling on them, which, you know, could kill them. Many of them are hit, or the needles go into their skin and it becomes infected. And then a lot of the little fruitlets will scatter all over the ground, and those need to be collected. And so oftentimes the man will have a quota, and he needs to cover a certain number of hectares every day, and he needs to have a certain amount of kilograms to meet the company quota, or the salary will be cut. So in order to do that, he will end up bringing his wife and sometimes the children as well to be able to get the amount of fruit he needs to meet this quota.
Can you tell us about how workers are forced into this labor? You open one of your pieces with Jem, and it says, Jem's words tumble out over the phone, his voice growing even more frantic. Between sobs, he says he's trapped on a Malaysian plantation run by government-owned Felda. His boss confiscated and then lost his Indonesian passport, leaving him vulnerable to arrest. And night after night, he has been forced to hide from authorities, sleeping on the jungle floor, exposed to the wind and the rain. And he said his biggest fear is the roaming tigers. How did Jem end up in this position?
Well, like many people, Jem came from a very poor part of Indonesia, which neighbors Malaysia. And many of the workers migrate, and there's a kind of a long history of migration from certain parts of Indonesia to certain parts of Malaysia. They share a very common similar language and culture, both Muslim countries. And so it's attractive. They think they can make more money, and they often can. So Jem migrated into Malaysia, got a job on this palm oil plantation, and, you know, had a passport. And then, you know, he finished the contract and wanted to leave. And basically they said, well, we've lost your passport. You know, if you try to leave, you'll be illegal. You can be caught by the authorities. You can be deported. You can wind up in these detention centers, which are very dismal places where, you know, you're very crowded, and there's not a lot of oversight. There's not sometimes enough food. It's not clean. Sometimes there's beatings. So Jem found himself in this situation, and he wanted to leave, and was being told, no, you need to go stay in the jungle at night, so you're not going to be caught if the authorities, you know, do a raid to see who has papers. And he was very desperate when we talked to him, and then eventually did just go ahead and make a run for it. And the story kind of describes his very harrowing journey trying to get back to Indonesia, you know, illegally crossing back over.
You report that some months, Jem and the others say they made as little as $10 a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's actually more than a lot of people make. You know, we found, I think, well, there were women that I talked to who were working for free and children who were working for free. But of those who actually had jobs, we found some making as little as $2 a day. So, you know, it can vary widely. But again, these are people who are doing very difficult jobs, very dangerous jobs. The women in particular, they spray, are typically the pesticide sprayers. And they're also the ones who are scattering the fertilizer. And so, you know, it's very hot. They might not have protective gear. And even if they do have it, they're forced to almost run. They're kind of walking very briskly, and it's hot, they're sweating. So, it's very hard to breathe if you have a bunch of, you know, masks on or other gear. So the women are working and they don't have full-time positions. They don't have benefits. And oftentimes they're doing very hazardous work.
Have you been in contact with Zoom recently?
Yes, we were in contact with him and he is home. And, you know, it's been very difficult for everyone, this pandemic. But he's with his family and he's okay.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Margie Mason, an investigative reporter and Asia medical reporter for the Associated Press. Margie and Robin McDowell worked on two very important investigations exposing widespread labor and human rights abuses, including rape, slavery, and child labor in the palm oil industry, which is worth a whopping $65 billion. Palm oil is in so many things: pet food, pesticides, pills, personal care products from some of the world's largest brands, including L'Oreal, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, and Colgate, which owns Tom's of Maine. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are discussing two AP investigations exposing widespread labor and human rights abuses in the palm oil industry. The investigation found that millions of men, women, and children from some of the poorest corners of Asia are exploited and forced into working on palm oil plantations in Malaysia and Indonesia. Some women make just $2 a day with no job protections or health care. Palm oil is in everyday products in major brands: Procter & Gamble, Colgate, L'Oreal, Nestle, Lysol. And the ingredient list often does not list palm oil. Sometimes it says palm, sometimes it's derivatives like sodium lauryl sulfates, for example. And today we are talking about these investigations with reporter Margie Mason, an investigative reporter for the Associated Press. If you have any questions or comments for Margie, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What will it take to protect these workers and regulate this really exploding industry? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Just to stay on the forced labor aspect of your reporting for a little while longer, you spoke to a Burmese man named Zin Koko Hetwe, who was essentially smuggled to work on a palm oil plantation in the early 2000s. And he told you that his bosses tied his hands together at gunpoint when he tried to leave. And he said, when Americans and Europeans see palm oil is listed as an ingredient in their snacks, they should know it's the same as consuming our sweat and blood. You spoke with some people who work to basically rescue workers who are forced into these fields against their will. Can you talk about just how these organizations operate and what they're able to do under these really difficult circumstances?
Well, oftentimes it might not be, you know, an organization set up specifically to rescue people. We found with our fishing reporting, you know, there was actually a couple of organizations that worked to try to work specifically with the fishing industry. But I mean, you have the IOM is fantastic, and they do a lot of work. And there's also NGOs, local NGOs. And in some cases, we found, you know, clergy, you know, individuals, people who just saw that there was a need. The Indonesian people are extremely warm-hearted, welcoming people. And, you know, one of the things that I have always just really loved about them is how they just open their homes oftentimes when they have very little to people who are in need. And we saw this, you know, happen as well in this particular case. So, you know, in some cases you have people who, may try to get help, and then instead of actually getting help and getting out, they are caught up in a system that sees them in Malaysia as undocumented or, being in the country illegally. And then they wind up kind of getting arrested or getting into an immigration detention center. And it might take some time, even with an NGO helping them, to get out. So we found that as well. So it's very complicated. And people who, I think one thing to point out is that, the people who wind up in these situations, especially the migrant workers or, any of them really, they're all poor people and they are trying to find a better life for themselves and for their families. And, they wind up getting oftentimes tricked and exploited and really taken advantage of.
When you spoke to these workers, what did they tell you about the changes that they would like to see beyond the obvious changes, of course, to end forced labor and to ensure that people are not harassed and raped on the job? I mean, beyond the obvious huge changes that are needed, what else stood out for you?
Well, the workers themselves, I think they want to do the work. They just want to be paid. They want to earn a fair wage. They're not looking for a handout. These are not people who are complaining. And this is extremely demanding work that most people would shun. But they're saying, no, we'll do the work, but just pay us what you told us that you were going to pay us and protect us. If we get sick, help us get medical care. Make sure that, we have... If their children are there, make sure that there's school available either in the plantation or that the company is providing some type of transport for the kids to be able to go to school. Many people complained about this kind of piecemeal system that is in place in a lot of plantations where, again, it's all built on the quota of, you need to get a certain amount of kilos per day, or you need to cover a certain number of hectares per day. And again, this might not be necessarily bad, but what happens is the quotas are so high, the targets are set so high that it's just impossible for one person to do it. And so then they end up having to recruit family members. And that's oftentimes, kids get pulled out of school to help the family, meet this daily target. And so then the system and the cycle just continues for generations.
So basically they want what we all want, basic protections on the job. We want to be paid a fair wage. We want to work in a safe environment. I mean, it's just every worker wants basic protections. Can you explain the sort of the supply chain, because, reading your stories, I was thinking about all the shows we've done about garments and sweatshop workers. And what has happened over the decades is these major brands like The Gap and Nike and Walmart and what have you, on and on, they try to wash their hands of it by saying, well, we've got these third-party contractors and they're the ones that need to deal with this. We hire a middleman, basically. And so we're not really responsible for what happens in the factory. Can you talk about the supply chain when we're discussing food and personal care products?
Yeah, so the supply chain in palm oil is, as you might expect, very complicated. There's, in some cases, you have companies, let's just say, I think like Unilever is one of the, it's a huge buyer of palm oil. And so, they will, in some cases, they'll have direct sources of palm oil. And they also have, like many other companies, third-party sources. And, a lot of the large companies have, again, because of the pressure from the environmental groups, they have been working to be more transparent, which is great. They are making their full supply chains, a lot of them, available now for people to actually look at, down to, in most cases, the palm oil mill, where they're getting their palm oil from. And you know, this is definitely a step in the right direction. However, you know, the let's just go back to Unilever again. I believe they had something like 1,500 or 1,600 mills that they source from. And so it's very difficult when you start looking at that number of mills and then think about all of the plantations feeding into those mills. How do you know what's going on? Again, you know, these plantations are vast. If you go to Google Earth, say, and try to zoom in on a plantation, you'll see it's like a green sea. They're enormous. You know, when you're in an airplane flying over, you know, Borneo in Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, you'll just, it just stretches as far as you can see on a clear day. So, you know, we're talking about massive, massive amounts of land that's being farmed with millions and millions of workers. And so it's a huge undertaking for any company to try to, you know, wrap their head around and figure out how to fix this problem that, again, has been in place for generations. But I think now there's starting to be more momentum where people are looking at this and saying, you know, this is a problem and we all know about it. We all know it's a problem. I mean, we're not telling them anything they don't know. So then what is the solution?
And since you brought up Unilever, they own so many brands. I'm looking on their website, 9 pages of brands, including Ben & Jerry's ice cream, Comfort, Dove, Hellman's, Lipton, I mean, Magnin. That's the thing. We're in an age now where these multinationals own all of these brands. And for someone who buys this stuff, sometimes you just have no idea. You know, like I remember when Colgate bought Tom's of Maine, we did a number of shows about how these, you know, natural companies were being bought by multinationals. A lot of people just don't know because it's Colgate is not on the tube of toothpaste. It says Tom's of Maine.
Right. So that's happening a lot. And, you know, you find palm oil. And again, it's in the supply chain. So, I mean, we're not saying, hey, this, you know, deodorant from Tom's of Maine that you're holding in your hand right now definitely has, you know, this kid that we talked to in Indonesia's, you know, labor, but it is in the supply chain for sure. And so if it's in the supply chain, and we like to always use this analogy, you know, even if the Nike shoe or the you know, the tennis shoe or whatever you're talking about, you know, has no problems with it. If you have a lace that's in there, that's made, it kind of taints the entire thing. And this is true with palm oil as well.
Today, we are speaking with Margie Mason, investigative reporter and Asia medical reporter for the Associated Press. She and Robin McDowell spoke to 130 current and former workers from 24 palm oil companies. And almost every worker complained about how they were treated. And I hope you can take some time to read their investigations. You can find the investigations along with a couple of videos. There's one video, Margie, that is just so powerful, where you actually show women holding the products that the palm oil is in. And I was just, it just hit me thinking about these women in Indonesia and Malaysia holding a $20 tube of lipstick. You spoke to a worker, DeFrida, who said that she would have to spray pesticides on 30 acres of rough jungle terrain to afford that $20 tube of lipstick. And she said, "Oh my God, please pay attention to our lives."
Yeah. So most of the people that we met, they just assumed that the palm oil that they were harvesting or helping to harvest was going into, you know, palm oil that they find on the shelves that's used for frying their food. They didn't really understand in most cases that this is going to Europe and America and other places, and it's being used in all of these different foods and all of these different cosmetics. And, you know, for me as a woman, you know, it was so heartbreaking a lot of times when I would like pull out, you know, I would carry something, a lipstick or an eyeliner or something in my bag, and I would pull it out and hand it to them. And they, you know, they've never seen lipstick maybe before. And then to say, you know, this costs this much money in the US and it has palm oil in it. And they were just, they couldn't believe it. They would just hold the lipstick and twist it up and down and talk about it. I mean, it, you know, it's unbelievable that people who earn so little, you know, when they kind of see where literally the fruit of their labor is going, it's just baffling to them.
Well, I want to talk about the women and the girls that you interviewed. And I just want to let listeners know that parts of what we're going to talk about contain graphic descriptions of rape and assault. So if you want to maybe turn your radio down, now would be a good time to do that. I just want to read from the piece you wrote, Rape, Abuse, and Palm Oil Fields Linked to Top Beauty Brands. With his hand clamped tightly over her mouth, she could not scream, the 16-year-old girl recalls, and no one was around to hear her anyway. She describes how her boss raped her amid the tall trees on an Indonesian palm oil plantation that feeds into some of the world's best-known cosmetic brands. He then put an axe to her throat and warned, "Do not tell." This kind of story is just told over and over again in your piece, Margie. Can you just talk about how common this is among the women and the girls who work in these fields?
I think it's really difficult to say how common it is. I think, like here in the US and everywhere else, women don't like to talk about this. And when you're dealing with women who, you know, are not educated and they're living in countries where this topic is extremely taboo, we found it was really hard. It, you know, there were times when women would tell us if, you know, if men were around, especially, they would say that there was no issue. And then later they would talk to us alone and say, actually, you know, this is really common. The harassment is very common, I think. You know, kind of younger, attractive girls being picked out and given easier jobs with sexual favors expected. You know, some women, if they don't do what is expected of them, then they can be punished and sent alone to work very, very far. And when I say far, I mean hours away from other people in remote sections of the plantation where, you know, there's snakes and wild boar and, you know, anything could happen and no one would ever know. So there's just a lot of pressure. And I think that it happens, to answer your question, I think it happens there just like it happens here. And I think that we're never going to know how prevalent it is. But we were really, and this was very important to me, to kind of get at this issue when I started hearing about it and to really at least try to bring it to light so that it's something that people are aware of, because there was nothing in the literature. No one had done any work on this, any reporting, any studies. It's really, we were really the first people to, I think, kind of start to even ask questions about it.
You spoke to Rosita Nengse, the director of the Women, Children, and Family Legal Aid Institution in the Indonesian province of West Kalimantan. And she recalled a case involving two Indonesian girls as young as 13 who were working on a plantation with their parents. They said they were repeatedly raped by the same supervisor until they both became pregnant 4 months apart. She said nothing happened to the four men. He is still free. The Malaysian government said it received no reports about rapes on plantations, but Indonesia acknowledged physical and sexual abuse. And you were able to corroborate a number of these stories by reviewing police reports, legal documents, complaints filed with union reps. And then you also interviewed 200 workers, activists, government officials, and lawyers who helped some girls and women escape. And they confirmed that these abuses regularly occur. What response have you received specifically to this aspect of your reporting about the rape and the sexual assault?
Well, I think there has been, I think we definitely hit a nerve with the public, because we've received a lot of feedback, a lot of emails, a lot of notes and information from people coming on social media concerned about this. You know, I think that the companies have responded and, you know, they have expressed in some cases concern, and they want to know, you know, can you tell us specifically who this is or where this is? And, you know, we obviously are not going to reveal, you know, rape victims to the companies where these women are working, because they're clearly terrified to talk about this. And they're terrified that if they were to come forward, there would be, they would face some type of, you know, reprisal. So I think that, you know, it's an issue, again, that's extremely taboo. The women feel like they don't want to make this public. They don't want anyone to know. It's very embarrassing. And so there's, again, it's not unlike what we see everywhere else in the world. You know, the Me Too movement definitely did not make it to the plantations that I visited. So I think, you know, people are concerned. They want to know more about it, but, you know, I think that there's going to have to be, you know, some kind of soul searching that goes into thinking about what's the best way to try to address this. And, you know, one thing that is obvious and is in some ways a simple first step is that, you know, we didn't find hardly any, a handful maybe of female supervisors. Almost all of the supervisors on the plantation are male. And so you have, first of all, women not being given any position or any way to advance. And these would be full-time positions with benefits. Again, you also have men who are going out into these remote areas, maybe with just one or two women, in some cases just with one woman, or with smaller groups. And so there's opportunity there. If the women were supervising the other women, there would be a lot less opportunity for, you know, harassment or sexual assaults to be happening in the fields. And again, it would also allow women to advance. So that's something that, you know, we pointed out in the story is an issue. And maybe that's something that could be, you know, looked at by the companies.
Margie, we only have about a minute or so left. Right after your investigation was published in September, Senators Sherrod Brown and Ron Wyden called on companies that buy goods tainted by these abuses to be held accountable. Do you have any updates on what lawmakers are trying to do or any action they're trying to take?
Well, I think that the action that I can talk about is that Customs and Border Protection, they did, as I mentioned earlier, they did ban all palm oil coming in from FGV Holdings, which is affiliated with FELDA. And I think that they may be looking at other companies as well. I mean, I think this is now on their radar, and that's not going to stop palm oil from coming in, but it's certainly sending a message that the U.S. Is looking at this industry now, and they have concerns about forced labor, child labor, and, you know, sexual abuse happening on the plantations.
What can citizens do about this?
That's a really difficult question. I think mainly at this point, you're boycotting, it's not going to work because it's the palm oil is just everywhere, as we've discussed. It's in everything, and it's impossible not to encounter it, I think, in your daily life. But I do think that engaging, you know, again, pressure the banks, pressure the companies, let them know this is something that, you know, it matters and that you care about. And I think that is one way to at least start to engage on this.
Well, we are getting a lot of emails from listeners who just say thank you for exposing this. And Margie, we'd love to have you back because we didn't get to spend enough time on child labor, and we didn't get enough time to talk about all of the pesticides that are using that are being used. Glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, is commonly used. Pesticides that are banned in Europe are commonly used, which are having really detrimental effects on women. Some are even losing their eyesight, which is horrific. So we would love to have you back to talk more about that and to also get an update on any action that is taken. So thank you so much for joining us. And please thank your colleague, Robin McDowell. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much. I would love to come back and talk more about this.
Great. Thank you. Margie Mason is an investigative reporter, an Asia medical reporter for the AP. And I hope you can take some time to read the pieces and really just sit for a minute with the video and the photos. It's just really incredible, and share it with others who might not know about how palm oil is now so pervasive. You can find those articles at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. And thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.